I think before I say anything on this subject of world peace, I'll just have this little word to you. You're a wonderful people. You've overwhelmed me. You've been so good to me and my wife this week, and you've said kind things, and even some of you that I knew didn't altogether agree with some of the concepts that I've had and some of the views I've expressed. I haven't assumed too much, I know, ever, in being sure that you would let me say what was on my mind, even though in instances it might be a shock to you, or it might not find a ready intellectual response. You might say, well, I'm not convinced. You knew, I'm pretty sure, that I was always speaking the truth in love. So I know I haven't assumed too much, for you've demonstrated that you have that feeling about me. And I can assure you that it's reciprocated. I love my Baptist brethren. And so out of a heart full of gratitude for the honors you've given me and for this sympathetic acceptance of my frailties, of my earnestness where some bulge of conviction has appeared. And I know these bulges sometimes have been rather pronounced. I suspect, too, that there have been times when I've been a little informal and I've told an Arkansas story when you wondered if it wouldn't be more fitting to have a dignified reference. And maybe not, but that's just being my natural self. And I've always admired the old man, the old settler. This is the only story I know, I guess, that didn't originate in Arkansas. This was from South Dakota, the western part of South Dakota, where the old settler lived, favorite among the boys. One Saturday, he didn't show up at the trading post. And Monday, the fellows around the store began to talk about it. They said the old settler didn't come in. Wonder what's happened to him. Maybe we ought to go out there and see if anything's wrong. And so they did. They rode out to his place. Sure enough, when they got there, the fences were down, the crops were trampled on, and everything was abandoned, and they found the old man lying on his back over in the corner of the yard, and an arrow was in his side. He was still perfectly rational. He was alive, and his eyes were open, and he was conscious, able to talk. But the first fellow that leaned over him said, "Aren't you in great pain?" "Well," he said, "it does hurt a little when I laugh." And I just feel that it doesn't really hurt us. We haven't got any error in our side. It isn't going to hurt us to laugh a little. And I've gone on that assumption. I'd hoped Walter Judd would get here. I noticed what J.D. Gray said tonight, or this afternoon, about my bragging on two members of the opposing party. Well, I want him to know that that was just an act of graciousness. I'm capable of being quite partisan. I'm like Senator Joe T. Robinson. I love my Republican friends, and I wish every good thing in life for them except public office. Yeah. But I know that Republicans are also capable of being partisan. I've heard Walter. Bless his heart, he ought to be here to defend himself, but he feels the same way about us Democrats.
He's coming in right there.
All right, well, he better get here. Well, I feel better now. I can relax. Oh, boy, what a narrow escape I had and you had. Sit down there and get your breath, Walter. I'm good for another 5 minutes.
I heard all those mean things you were saying about me.
I was going to tell them how Republicans can be partisan, too. I think the old man over in northern Ohio carried it too far. He was in a little Methodist prayer meeting, and there are more Republicans and Methodists to the square yard in northern Ohio than any place in the world. And this old man said in the prayer meeting, "Lord, we thank thee for this great land we live in, and wonderful men who have made it what it is, the heroes of the past, men like Lincoln and Grant and McKinley and Garfield and Roosevelt, Theodore, that is." "I present a man whose eloquent voice and dedicated heart and mind have been devoted to the great interests of the kingdom of God and of the nation that he loves. A missionary in China, a prisoner of the Japanese, an outstanding surgeon, a man who lives for other people, who loves his family, his church, his country. He was born in Rising, Nebraska, just 30 days after I was born, in London, Arkansas. I shouldn't take further time. He's been a delegate to the United Nations, ranking member of the Foreign Affairs Committee. He remembers when I used to be a member of the Congress. And I served with him on the Foreign Affairs Committee, and we worked together, and I can tell you that we never remembered that he's a Congregationalist and I'm a Baptist, or that he's a Republican and I'm a Democrat. We both love our Lord, and we love young people, and we love our country, and we love humanity. You know we do. And that's what we've been trying to show as we have tried to develop some craftsmanship that would be worthy of you. I think I've talked long enough to enable him to get his breath. He's had a hard trip, I'm confident. The planes have been running late, and I want him to be composed when he stands here. One of our greatest men, Walter H. Judd.
Thank you very much, Brooks Hayes. You certainly have got these Southern Baptists mighty well trained down here, because it's been so long since I've seen anybody up in my part of the country stand up for a member of Congress that it flabbergasts me. He said that he had seniority over me. That's right, and you get ahead in Washington on a basis of seniority, or as we sometimes call it there, senility. And I got in the door out there when he was telling stories on Republicans, and I felt that I was entitled maybe to tell one on him. He got the Roosevelts mixed up, you recall. Way back in 1944 in the Republican, or in the presidential campaign, they used to tell a story up in the North about a colored gentleman down in the South who was a red-hot Roosevelt Democrat. And some of his friends were guying him a little bit, and they said, well, Rastus, they said, of course, if the Republicans put up Mr. Dewey, why, naturally, you'd be against Mr. Roosevelt, be for Mr. Roosevelt. But suppose the Republicans were to put up George Washington, the father of his country, you wouldn't be for Mr. Roosevelt then, would you? Oh, yes, I would. Well, now, suppose the Republicans put up Abraham Lincoln, the man who freed the slaves. You wouldn't be for Mr. Roosevelt then, would you? Oh, yes, I would. Well, they said, now, Uncle, you're a good Baptist. Suppose the Republicans had put up the good Lord himself as their candidate. You wouldn't be for Mr. Roosevelt then, would you? Oh, yes, I would. Well, why? Well, Rasta said, the good Lord, he say, seek and ye shall find. Mr. Roosevelt say, sit down, I'll bring it to you. I can't take all that from him without shooting back a little. You'll understand my position. He's got allies here. I'm a foreigner for sure down here. But I'm awful happy that I did manage to make it. An airplane is a wonderful way to travel if you're not in a hurry and have lots of time. The plane got into Washington on time, but it took it 50 minutes to get a ramp where they could unload their passengers from Boston. And then when we got loaded on, they went out to the end of the runway, and the pilot said, well, bad news, there are 16 planes lined up ahead of us. I estimate it'll take us 40 minutes to get off. Well, he missed it 3 minutes. We got off in 37. I suppose you here felt a little bit like that fellow who was getting ready to take a parachute jump. And he was apprehensive, and the sergeant said, you just do what I tell you and everything will work out all right. When I say jump, you jump and start counting to give you time to get free from the plane. You count 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, and then you pull this big ring over your chest, and that'll open up your parachute. You'll float down, be no trouble at all. But we recognize that once in a while the parachute doesn't open, so we've thought about that, and if that happens, you just keep your head and you count 4,000, 5,000, 6,000, then you pull this little ring, and that'll open up the pilot chute, and then that'll open up the main chute, and you'll float down. There'll be a truck there, pick you, and the chute up, take you back to the base. Not a thing to worry about. So they got up, and the sergeant said, "This is it, jump." And the fellow swallowed hard, jumped, and started counting. 1,000, 2,000, 3,000. Pull this ring, nothing happened. 4,000, 5,000, 6,000. Pull this ring, nothing happened. He looked down, he saw the earth rushing up at him. He said, "I'll bet that truck won't be there either." Well, I fooled you. The truck arrived. And I don't know any greater honor that I've ever had than to be invited to speak to Brooks Hayes, folks. You know how all of us who know him love this fella. And I know no greater honor than to have a chance to sort of be a pinch hitter for the President of the United States. And most of all, I'm happy to be here to have a chance to talk to you Christian folks. I don't have to argue, or no one has to argue with you about why we should be Christians. You're committed to Jesus Christ, and you want to do what's right, and so do I. And we're here primarily to figure out or find out how better to witness for him and to serve him and his kingdom in the world. We want to be good and ever better disciples. We don't argue whether, but how. Don't discuss whether, but how can we do the very best that is possible for us to do with the gospel that we're utterly sure is the hope of the world. We Christians think the only hope of the world. Now, your meeting this year comes at a time which is characterized, I suppose, by as much confusion, as great a mixture of emotions as at any time in the history of our country. On one hand, never was there any people with greater cause for gratitude than we have. We're free in this land, and Baptists and Congregationalists care about that in every walk of life, religious and secular. No dictator has seized this land and is trying to force us into his pattern. We're at peace, at least in the sense that no American boys are killing or being killed around the world. When half the people of the world don't know how they're ever going to get enough to eat, I say ever, not just next year, but ever, they don't have enough land, and they're never going to have enough land. We're debating today in the Congress, what are we going to do about the surpluses that are piled up all around us, the fruits of this blessed and bountiful land? We've got problems here. You know them and I know them, but we're working at them and we're going to find ways through them. Well, isn't everything complete? What more could anybody ask for? And yet you know that right at the time when we're so grateful for the goodness of life that's possible for us in this land, there probably never was a time characterized by greater uneasiness and uncertainty within our people than exists today. You see it, and believe me, in the letters that come to a congressman's desk. The people who have the most are the ones who were most anxious. There's dismay, perplexity. Only 14 years ago we won a war with total unconditional surrender of all our enemies. We had every advantage. And here we are 14 years later talking about, believe it or not, survival. How could so much be lost? What went wrong? What mistakes did we or others make that the victory bought at so great a price could have almost slipped through our fingers? We're profoundly thankful that no such thing happens here as we saw happening in Hungary a couple of years ago, or as happening in Tibet in the last 2 months. But we're profoundly uneasy that that kind of thing could be happening anywhere to human beings, God's children, on this planet, in the middle of the enlightened 20th century. We feel, I think, uneasily that Korea's not going to go on indefinitely, half slave and half free. It's all going to be free, or it's all going to be communist. And we know that Vietnam, and we know that Berlin and Germany are not going to go on indefinitely, half communist and half free. They're all going to be free, both sides, or they're going to be communist. And I think we have a sort of a premonition in our souls that this one planet, so contracted today, is not going to go on indefinitely, half communist and half free. It's all going to be free, including the people now captives, or it's all going to be communist, including the United States and in our lifetime. These are the things that distress men and drive some almost to despair. They have practically lost hope and abandoned themselves to a struggle by arms which they know will destroy, if not humanity, at least every value that you and I have come to treasure and love. Now, on top of this mixture of emotions, there is confusion on specific issues. Equally sincere, high-minded, conscientious Christian men and women take exactly opposite views on important issues. They can't both be right, one side or the other. Maybe both are wrong, but they can't both be right. Let me give you just some illustrations too, as evidence of the confusion, and if Christians are so confused about what's right in given situations, how can we ask others perhaps to lead the way? For example, in this conflict which occupies all of our attention, the one that's responsible for your taxes being so high and your boy going to spend at least 2 years in the armed services on one or another of the five continents, not back in the hometown from which you come. One group of Christians will say, well, we got to start compromising with these communists. And another group will say, no, we must stop compromising. This is how we got into the trouble. And another will say, well, we must relax the tensions. Yield a little bit here and there to relax the tensions. And other Christians, equally sincere, will say, you must never relax the tensions until the cause of the tension is removed. There's only one cause of the tension, the enslavement of 900 million peoples and the announced intention to impose the same rule on all the rest of the people. And when the communists in Berlin say, we want a free Berlin, others come back and say, we want a free Germany. Just free the people. Free the people. Have elections and the tension will be gone in a half hour. And until you do free the people, you must never relax the tension against that tyranny. I was brought up in medicine in a period when we didn't know much about typhoid fever. But we knew they had a high fever, and just before they died, their fever got higher and higher, so it seemed logical to bring down the fever. And the standard treatment was to put them in ice-cold baths to get down the fever. Well, it did bring the fever down, usually killed the patients, but we got the fever down. Are we going to deal with just symptoms or with causes? And somebody will say, but we got to go to a conference and get another agreement. We must have an agreement. And other Christians will say, no, what we need is not new agreements. We got all kinds of agreements. What's the use of signing new agreements today with the people who won't keep the agreements we signed with them yesterday? Isn't this just self-deception? Honest. And somebody will say, but if these two wolves, the United States and the Soviet Union, would just quit snarling at each other, then we could sit down and talk it out in a civilized way. And other Christians will say, but that is not an accurate description of the situation. It is not two wolves snarling at each other. It's a wolf which has announced its intention to divide and devour the flock, and a shepherd dog, Uncle Sam, trying its level best to defend the flock at the urgent request of the flock. And what kind of a shepherd dog would be if he didn't try to defend the flock against destruction? I'm not trying to make a case for either side at the moment. I'm trying to give you a measure of the depth of the confusion that exists. And some people will say, but we must never speak of these other folks as our enemies. And Christians will say, they declare, other Christians will say, they announce, they declare that they are enemies of God. And how can a man be an enemy of God without being an enemy of a Christian? Confusion. And someone will say, well, at least we must forgive them. And others must say, you must love them. Others will say, you must love them to the end. But you cannot forgive. At least God never promised forgiveness to anybody until he turned from his evil ways and repented of his sins. Then he promised, but not until. Jesus on the cross forgave this a thief on one side who repented. He did not forgive the thief on the other side. Does that mean Jesus was discriminatory? Playing favorites? Partiality? Unwilling to be generous and forgive this second thief? No, he yearned with every ounce of his loving heart to forgive that thief, but he couldn't because the thief wouldn't repent and wouldn't let Jesus forgive him. And somebody will say, well, if we just stand for liberty and justice for all, ordinarily that'll work, but we can't talk about that now. Because if we talk about liberty and justice for all as our foreign policy, and that's what it is, but we mustn't talk about it because that might encourage some young people in Hungary to think that liberty and justice meant liberty and justice for them. And that might encourage some people in China or Poland or in the Soviet Union itself to want liberty and justice for all. And that might set up the war that we want to avoid. And in that war, we might not be able to get liberty and justice for those who've been deprived of it, and we might lose it for ourselves. And what good would that do anybody? And others will say, but if we don't stand everlastingly for liberty and justice for all, how can we ask or expect God to help us preserve our own? You see, you could go on indefinitely. Well, why such confusion? I think the basic reason for the confusion is not because we're different grades or degrees of Christians, all are trying to do the right thing. It's because we haven't studied thoroughly enough the nature of this struggle. We haven't understood the real nature of this world struggle. We've seen that it's a conflict of arms, yes. That's why our taxes are so high, and that's why we read about missiles and all sorts of new gadgets and weapons of destruction. And we also know that it's a conflict of economic systems, which will crack up the first under this load. If we don't spend more and more, at least to keep up in arms, then one day they say to us, surrender, and we have to surrender or be destroyed. That is, if we don't keep up with arms, we invite insecurity and disaster. But if we do spend more and more and more, and our budget's unbalanced, and our currency becomes more inflated, and your life savings systematically destroyed, we invite inflation and disaster. Either way, disaster. How would you vote in the midst of this conflict? And we have understood, I think, fairly well that it's a conflict of educational systems, which will produce not only the smartest but the toughest minds. Our system, which believes completely in freedom, allows you to study the Bible or to study science or to study Pilgrim's Progress or the Declaration of Independence if you wish, but allows you to spend the time in front of the television set or reading the pulp magazines or the cheap stuff in the funny papers, or maybe not study at all. I saw a figure this last week that disturbed me, that the average industrial worker in America spends between 41 and 42 hours at his job, and he spends 22 hours each week in front of a television set. Now, this is more dangerous than the atom bombs, because this is a change in man. He doesn't want to be disturbed. He isn't out discussing it, even down at the Cracker Barrel, arguing with his neighbors, out of which some growth comes, sitting there watching it, watching it, watching it, avoiding trouble. Go away, leave us alone. Not out trying to solve problems, but just enjoy the world. No society has ever endured, no matter what its weapons, if it didn't have people who understood the issues well enough and had the vigor and the vitality and the determination to stand strongly for the things they believe. It's a conflict of wills. Which will work the harder? This last spring, a year ago, in my city of Minneapolis, in one of the largest high schools in the best part of town, out of 400 students in the 12th grade graduating class, the top five honor students were children of refugees who came to this country from refugee camps in Europe in the last 7 or 8 years. Now, does that mean they're smarter than American youngsters? Of course not. They work harder. They appreciate it. Means something to them. These are signs that you can't brush aside. But this conflict is more than these. This conflict, more than arms and economic systems and educational systems and wills, It's a conflict between two totally different philosophies of life, two totally different set of values, two totally different ways of looking at things. And this conflict comes out of a still deeper conflict. It's a conflict of faith. One teaches men to hate God. And you can't be taught to hate God very long without hating man. And the other teaches men to love God. Out of which, if there is genuine love and discipleship, gradually there develops greater and more inclusive love of man. These are irreconcilable, let's be blunt about it. One or the other has got to change before they can be merged. There is no shortcut. On one hand, there's a group that says there is no God. There is no moral order. There are no such things as right and wrong and truth and falsehood and good and evil. There are no absolutes. There is no such thing in the spiritual world as a North Star that you can count on and by which you can plan your course. And when it comes to man, they say that man is merely the smartest of the animals. He's the animal with the biggest brain. He's an animal with a mind, period, but no more. Now, if that's what they believe, nobody should get upset about their behavior. Does it bother you to spray some DDT on some troublesome mosquitoes? No, it doesn't bother me. If man is just an animal, then nobody should get upset that they do what they did in Hungary or what they do in Tibet. They're spraying DDT on some troublesome animals that are in their way. They don't do these things because they're bad. They do these things because they believe communism, and communism is atheism. Not because they're bad, it's because they're communists. No reason for hate. It is a reason for study and analysis. This is total conflict. On the other side, our society was founded by men who believed there is a God. They couldn't prove it, but nobody could prove it wasn't true. But they believed it. They wrote, you recall, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created." There is the first great act of faith. Everything else comes from that. There is a creator. And that leads immediately to the next thing, that there is a moral order in the universe. There are such things as right and wrong. I can violate God's moral laws, but I can't break them. Any more than I can violate his laws of electricity with impunity. I can grab a hold of that wire and say, "You can't tell me that will kill me." I'll laugh at God's laws of electricity, but it will kill me just the same. There is a North Star. I don't have to walk according to it, but there is a way by which I could be sure. I can plane my wood against the grain, or I can plane with the grain, but there is a grain. And the communists say there is no such thing as a grain. Man is what he's been taught to be by his parents. And so if the communists can conquer the world and destroy the capitalistic system, why? Because it believes in the institution of private property. And they say it's the possession of individuals of private property which gives them this sense that they are individuals in their own right, that they have importance apart from the masses. And if you can conquer the world and destroy the institution of private property so people don't own anything, then they won't want things. And then you don't need any policemen because they won't try to get anything. And then the state will wither away. And then you'll have a perfect society. It's so attractive, so plausible. Get love by hate. Get construction by destruction. But we believe there's a moral order in the universe. You can violate it, you can't break it. And when it comes to man, our society was founded by people who believe that man is the smartest of the animals. Yes, but he's something more. He is a creature of God. He's a child of God. And therefore, he has something of God in him, as your boy has something of you in him. And that boy can respond to you and become more and more like you if he's willing to respond to your love and yearning quest for him. And so man has something of God in him. He's a part of God. He has a spark of the divine. And this is the thing that's different in character, quality, kind from anything any animal has
This is the precious thing about man. This is the unique thing about man. He can become more and more like God if he'll respond to God's loving quest for him. You see, so often in America, people still seem to think that the conflict between the free world or the Western society with its basic values right out of the Christian religion on one hand and the communist world on the other is a conflict like that between the Republicans and Democrats in this country. Now, what is the conflict between the Republicans and Democrats? It's not a conflict over objectives. They all want this country to be strong, free, people happy, prosperous, good jobs, good homes, good character, good morals. What's the difference? It's a difference over means. It's a difference over which is the better way to get those objectives and keep them. This is a real difference, but it's a difference over means, not a difference over ends. And our conflict with the communists is not like that. It's not a conflict over different ways to the same objectives. It's a conflict over objectives. We're not pursuing the same objective. It's not over means, it's over ends. What do we want? Peace. What do they want? Conquest. What do we want? End the struggle. What do they want? Win the struggle. Not trying to get together. This is why in all the conferences we haven't been able to get a real agreement, because we're not pursuing the same objectives. And why aren't we pursuing the same objectives? Because we don't believe the same things about man and about God and about the universe. This is the kind of struggle in which we are engaged. Well, how can we seek first the things that are right in this kind of a world? How can we seek peace and pursue it? Seems to me there are about three ways we can do it. All medical students, at least who took psychiatry, I'm sure have heard this old wheeze that my professor told us at the end of our course in psychiatry. He said, "Gentlemen, when you get out there and you're dealing with patients and you've got a complicated case and you can't figure out just what the individual has, there's a simple rule to remember. A psychotic is a man who says, or a person who says, 2 and 2 are 5. A neurotic is a person who says 2 and 2 are 4, and I can't bear it." Now, this is a good rule. Helped me out many, many times. The fellow that says 2 and 2 are 4, he's crazy. And there are people who try to get peace by being crazy. They think that they can get peace by bowing down before the oppressor. They usually call it disengagement or a realistic readjustment, but it's another surrender. We're not doing too well on the 50-yard line, so let's back up to the 30-yard line. Don't call it a retreat, call it a realistic readjustment. But that isn't the way you win the football game. And others believe that maybe we can get peace by abandoning others to the enslavement. We're saying, many people are saying, well, it's too bad about the Poles, it's too bad about the Czechs, it's too bad about all those folks, but after all, let's recognize their enslavement. Let's accept, as Mr. Khrushchev is always demanding, the historic changes. That is, we'll say to him, now, we're too bad what you're doing to those folks, but if you'll just do those bad things to those folks and leave us alone, it'll be all right. And we're going to get peace by that. And then there are people who think the way to get a strong United Nations, and I'm glad you're going to send an observer up there, but there are people who think the way to get a strong United Nations is to bring in all the lawless elements in the country. They call that realism. They'll say, well, communist China's there. Be realistic. Of course she's there, but realism demands that you don't bring her in. There are gangsters in Chicago. Do you say... There are gangsters in Chicago, do you say, bring them into the FBI? Let's be realistic. Now, how can the FBI deal with the gangsters if it doesn't have the gangsters in the FBI to help the FBI plan its campaign against the gangsters? That's realism. And then they'll say, but if the United Nations ought to be universal, it ought to have everybody in it. This is a government that's been established in China, and why shouldn't we have it in? Universal. What they're saying is that you can get peace or get a strong United Nations by destroying and making a mockery of the Charter of the United Nations and the principles behind it in order to get what looks like it'll be a temporary gain. The Charter is not a document that you can ignore. It's written down in black and white. It isn't a matter for argument.
And there isn't even any Supreme Court to change the language yet of the United Nations, so you don't know what it means. You can go read the Charter of the United Nations. What does it say? It says membership shall be open to other peace-loving nations. That will do what? That will accept the obligations of the Charter. And what is the first obligation? To refrain from the use or threat of force in international disputes. We're not keeping communist China out. It isn't because Mr. Dulles is stubborn and rigid. They're keeping themselves out. They won't qualify. They'll be in the first day of the next session of the General Assembly, and they could have been in the United Nations any day in the last 8 years if they would have agreed to accept the commitments and refrain from the use of force. But this, they openly proclaim they will not do. We've met with them 87 times at Geneva and Warsaw, trying to get them to do just two things. Just two. One, let out the prisoners of war that they promised at Panmunjom to let out, and haven't let out. Why? Because we care about boys. Maybe they're all dead, but their mothers don't believe it. At least account for them. And the other reason is we want those boys is because we'd like to have them keep their word just once. If just once they would keep their word, there'd be some sense in going in and signing another agreement. They've never been willing to do it. The other thing we've been negotiating with them about for 87 meetings for 3.5 years is to get them to accept the obligations of the Charter and agree to refrain from the use of force in settlements. And yet people will say we must have them in, pull the Charter down to the lowest level of international lawlessness instead of lifting people up to peace-loving status. Somebody says, well, you got the Soviet Union in, what's the difference? But the time the Soviet Union came in, she was keeping her obligations. She didn't break them on a vast scale until after we had recognized her. And the fact that you got one in is not a reason why you should take another. It's all the more reason why you shouldn't take another, because you know better now. Well, you say, if you aren't going to take communist China in, why don't you kick the Soviet Union out? It's a good question, but the answer is, you can't kick them out, because the Charter is so fixed up that the Soviet Union can veto its own expulsion. So there's no use arguing about kicking out when it can veto its own expulsion. I believe in the United Nations. Brooks Hayes and I went all over these United States trying to get a stronger and more workable United Nations. And we introduced 3 or 4 times bipartisan resolution and a Republican and a Democrat to show that this was not a partisan matter. This was an American matter. Nobody's worked harder for it and longer than he and I. And it just breaks my heart to see people advocating that maybe if we just bring the gangsters in and pull the United Nations down and make scraps of paper of the Charter, then we'll get peace. This is crazy. 2 times 2 are 5. You can't get peace that way. Some people imagine you can get trust by being untrustworthy. Last fall, an Englishman said to me, well, why not give Taiwan and Kimoi to the communists? They're just islands. I said, why not give them England? That's just an island. I couldn't get him interested in that. Going to get peace by sacrificing our principles and other people's territory. And a lady came up to me in my own city when somebody said, well, we've got to give and take. I said, well, what will we give this time? You can't give Poland, we gave that last time. You can't give East Germany, we gave that before. You can't give Manchuria, North Korea, we've given all those. What would you give this time? West Germany? And I said, since we're here in Minnesota, let's begin by giving them Minnesota. Well, I couldn't get anybody interested up there. They might give them Arkansas, Brooks, or Florida. But they weren't going to give them Minnesota. And this pastor's wife came up, and her face was torn. She said, but Dr. Judd, you're a Christian. Don't you believe in going the second mile? Don't you believe in returning good for evil, turning the other cheek? And I said, sure. That's why I said, give them Minnesota. I can't find where Jesus said, if they ask for your territory, give him China's territory. I can't find where he says, if they ask for your coat, give him Poland's cloak. Give your own. Going to buy peace by being untrustworthy. And if you break your word to the little ally, can the big ally trust you? I tell you, and this jars you, I tell you that you find from Greece clear around to Japan,
In every one of those countries, they have two fears. One fear is of the communists, and the other fear is of the United States. Jolts you. The fears are different. Their fear of the communists is what they know the communists will do if they're able to get control. Their fear of us is what we may not do. They're fearful that we'll go to another conference and the communists will offer some kind of a deal that looks as if it'll be good for us and we'll take it at the expense of other people. They're afraid to trust us. Once I was talking to Mr. Nehru. I tried to get him to see there was some hope for India with the West. There was none with the communists. And he turned to me and his eyes blazed. He said, it's too dangerous to be an ally of the United States. Look at China. He was afraid to trust us. Tibet has wakened him up. So he knows now that regardless of what was said about us being imperialist and so on, it wasn't the case. And an Indian in Washington told me this last week, he said, it's novel for us to hear us ourselves called imperialist, interventionist, reactionaries. We always believed it when they said it about you, and now they say it about us in India after all Mr. Nehru did to try to please them, going to get peace by bowing down before Baal. That's crazy. There's a second way. That's the way of the neurotic. Two and two are four, yeah, and I can't bear it because it's too hard. He wants an easy way. He wants more for less. He wants magic. He wants to be able to push a button, sign a piece of paper, and then go away and forget about it. It's a bad dream. But you can't get peace that way. There's a third way. I must not take too much time. There's a third way, and that's the way we Christians must follow. And what's that way? It's two and two are four. And I can bear it. In fact, I rejoice that two and two are four. Thank God two and two are four. You can't get trust by being untrustworthy, but you can get trust by being trustworthy. You can't get justice by building up tyranny and injustice, but you can get justice by being steadfast in support of justice. Jesus said, you tithe mint and anise and cumin and neglect the weightier matters of the law. Justice and mercy, not or mercy. Not sentimentality or harsh justice. Justice with mercy. And mercy according to God's laws. And what else? And faith. What faith? Faith that justice and mercy will prevail if we will have faith in them and stick to them. Jesus put it, seek ye first peace? No. He didn't say that. And sometimes I hear people say, Jesus said, or the angels did, peace on earth. Now don't quit there. That's the second. What's the first say? Glory to God in the highest. Then peace on earth. That's the consequence. We want to have the peace on earth because that's convenient. But don't bother about, first of all, glory to God in the highest.